Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For 2 months in the spring of 2016, the world watched as wildfire ravaged the Canadian town of Fort McMurray. Firefighters named the fire the Beast. It acted like a mythical animal alive with destructive energy, and they hope never to see anything like it again. Yet it's not a stretch to imagine we will all soon live in a world in which fires like the Beast are commonplace. And after this year's historic wildfires in Southern and Northern California, Montana, the Pacific Northwest, and British Columbia, it appears that future is already happening. This morning we talk with Canadian journalist and explorer Edward Strutzik, author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future, about the science, economics, and politics of wildfires and the way that we and the wilder inhabitants of the forests around us, our cities and towns, might yet flourish in an age of growing megafires. Ed, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start by talking about the fire in Fort McMurray, which I found really disturbing when I started hearing about it a year and a half ago. And one of the reasons it disturbed me so much was because I was familiar with Fort McMurray as kind of being ground zero for the tar sands exploration. So I wanted to talk both about why that fire was so extreme, but it's the connections between the fact that that fire was happening and what the main industry of Fort McMurray is. So let's first start by just talking about how that fire started and what made it stand out so much and to the terror of so many people who were witnessing it.
Well, it's pretty clear that the fire was started by an all-terrain vehicle that was traveling in the forest during the springtime when things were tinder dry. It was probably one of the driest, warmest springs in recorded history, and it was probably a spark that came off from the muffler, you know, some twigs or whatever got caught under the undercarriage, and that's probably just how it got started. The problem at that time was that water bombers were located about an hour and a half, 2 hours away. There wasn't one stationed in Fort McMurray at the time. And so by the time the bombers got there, that fire had got to a stage where it really couldn't be stopped. The winds were driving it forward with such force and intensity that all they could really do was try to slow it down and steer it in another direction.
Now, how far was the start of the fire from the town of Fort McMurray?
It was about 5 or 6 miles, and that, I think, is probably the most pertinent thing to what happened over the next 3 days, is that when a fire is that close to a community, pretty much anything can happen, because embers can travel 2 miles if they're driven by wind, and they can ignite fires in advance. These kind of fires also create their own lightning storms, and that's what happened in this case as well. And really, that town should have probably been evacuated or put on high alert right away, told everybody to get packing on the Sunday 2 or 3 days ahead of when they actually did. And that just didn't happen.
Why was that?
Well, like most communities and cities, we're just not prepared to deal with fire. We're pretty good when it comes to tornado warnings and hurricane warnings. But when it comes to wildfire, most cities don't have a plan in place or an evacuation plan in place, in spite of all of the experience that we've had in the last 20 years, all the close calls that we've had. And so what happened in this case was that everybody was kind of forced to fend for themselves. The schools, teachers had to organize an evacuation with the help of the RCMP, but the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. But the police didn't know there was a fire until it actually got into town. And, they had people in hospitals. They were trying to evacuate those people in the middle of the night, the maternity ward, the chronic care ward. Everybody was just scrambling. And the fortunate thing about Fort McMurray, whatever you want to say about it, it is a tar sands community, and most of the people that live there work for the industry. And when they work for the industry, they have to go through a very rigid training program, because a lot bad can happen at one of these plants. And so they're instructed to basically obey orders, And when that came, when the evacuation order finally came, everybody knew what to do, and everybody was fairly young as well. There's not a lot of old people living in Fort McMurray, and so it's a fairly mobile population of people, and so they were able to get out.
What was interesting to me to be watching was, I mean, there seemed to be some confusion about which way people should evacuate, and it had a lot to do, I think, with where the fire is burning at what time. But I think people started out, and let's just also, for listeners who don't know where Fort McMurray is, let's just kind of place it. Where is it in Alberta?
It's in the north-central part of Alberta. It would be about a five-hour drive north of Edmonton, which is the capital city, an eight-hour drive north of Calgary, if people know Calgary better than they know Edmonton.
They often do. So actually, it's pretty far up there, because Edmonton is already, about halfway up the province.
Yeah, it's quite remote. There's only one highway going in and one highway going out. There is a highway that goes north into the oil sands. And what was really fortunate in this case was that they twinned that highway. It had just been completed, the twinning of that highway, weeks before the fire started. So that helped expedite the evacuation of people. Had that highway been just a two-lane highway at that point of time, I think we would have seen a lot more casualties.
Actually, I was just thinking, when Elizabeth Colbert wrote her piece about tar sands in the New Yorker several years ago, it was like, I think, the first big article about tar sands that was written. She described that highway between Fort McMurray and the tar sands fields as the highway of death, basically. Yeah, there were so many accidents, and people were just speeding, and there was a lot of drinking. So I find it interesting that they had maybe started to make that highway a little safer just in the nick of time for the evacuation.
Yeah, there had been a lot of pressure put on the Alberta government to twin that highway, because there had been so many accidents, so many people had died, a combination of just a lot of people trying to get out for the weekend. As I think Elizabeth pointed out, that, you know, drinking is a problem, partying is a problem, and you have a lot of these big trucks that move slowly and people are trying to pass them along the way, and it's just a recipe for disaster. And so that highway was finally twinned. In fact, it wasn't officially opened at the time of the fire, but they removed the barriers so that people could drive down south on both north-south lanes.
Well, I found it, and people in the beginning seemed like they were trying to get towards Edmonton, because there's more services if you could get the least, you know, towards that 5 hours towards Edmonton. But then that road was closed, and so people were being shunted up towards the tar sands operations, where there are a number of kind of camps, workers' camps and things like that. But it seemed like this pointed out a certain kind of direness when you have an emergency like this in an area that's so remote and so far from services.
It is, you know, and without a plan, people don't really know what to do. In the case, there was some quick thinking by the RCMP and the emergency response people, that they realized that traffic was backing up like crazy going south. And so recognizing that the tar sands industry was in a slowdown phase at that time because of low oil prices, many of the camps were either empty or only partially filled. And so they decided to send those people north where they could have beds and they could have food supplied to them. And again, that was just one of those things that was fortunate. Everything went the way that it, you know, should have. Had it been a busy time, that wouldn't have been an option.
Now, one of the chilling images of that fire was seeing block after block of neighborhoods in Fort McMurray that were just burned to the ground, which was correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the first wildfire that I'm aware of that had such an impact on an urban area. Is that correct?
In Canada, yes. I think, you know, we can start now looking at California.
Well, I mean, everything in California, I mean, if this isn't, we'll get there, you know, that yeah. Cities are burning in California, like right now as we're speaking. But that was the thing that struck me when I was following the fire in Fort McMurray and thinking, this is burning a town. Why is it burning a town? What is it that is making this town so vulnerable, and what kind of ominous predictions does this have for the future?
Well, there's a number of things at play here. Number one is that we have increasingly more and more people living in forested landscapes. In the United States, there's now 46 million single-family homes and several thousand businesses and 120 million people living and working in and around the country's forests. And we have a similar situation in Canada. The more people you have in the forest, the more likely you're going to have a fire, because people, more than lightning, cause fires on both sides of the border. And number two, you've got, you know, climate change is heating up the forests. It's drying them out. It's causing more lightning. And so it's just making the chances of fire igniting a lot higher. And number three is that we've always had these extreme fires, at least in you know, places like Montana and in northern in Canada, but they haven't burned near communities. And I think that what's happening now is the combination of climate change, more and more people living, working, and playing in these forest environments, is that the odds just continue to rise that the forested cities and communities are more vulnerable than ever before.
Well, one of the things that really disturbed me in the coverage, the international coverage of the Fort McMurray fire, was that there was very little mention that of what the impact of the main industry in Fort McMurray or near Fort McMurray was, and its connection possibly to the conditions that were creating that fire. Namely, the tar sands is one of the major carbon emitters, both in its processing and then in what it's producing and the end result of what it produces in the world. Was that one something that jumped to your mind? Is like, this is, I mean, in a very kind of dark way, this was like the fitting way for Fort McMurray to go. It's kind of being destroyed by its own success in a way.
Well, you know, there's no question that the tar sands are one of the drivers of fossil fuel emissions, and fossil fuel emissions are increasing temperatures around the world. It's not just in Canada or northern Alberta. And so, you know, I think it was ironic in the sense that here was the center of all of that fossil fuel activity burning, and you couldn't ignore it. But in Canada, it is such an economic driver. You know, it's so important to the economy that people just don't want to make the link. And so they put the blinders on. And the media, I'd have to say, was very reluctant, in some cases tried not to make any connection between climate change and the Fort McMurray fire, which is ridiculous. I mean, you can say, you know, it's pretty hard to link one fire to climate change, because fires have always been part of our landscape. But there's a pattern of events that have been evolving in our forest. Forests are burning bigger, hotter, faster, and more often. And it's unquestionable that climate change is one of the reasons why that's been happening.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Canadian journalist and explorer Edward Strzycik, who's the author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. And we've been talking about the Fort McMurray fire a year and a half ago up in northern Alberta. And let's move now to what's going on right now in California. And do you see the basically harbingers of what's happening now from the fire in Fort McMurray a year and a half ago?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, California has always been the hotbed of fire activity. You know, it began with the Oakland Hills fire, which was, you know, it resulted in, the stoppage of a football game in San Francisco, where the 49ers were pummeling the Detroit Lions, I think.
Actually, I just want to interject. That's the first fire I remember where it was a wildfire that burned in a city.
Yeah,
and I was talking to friends, one friend who was evacuated, another friend who was living further in the flatlands, who we were on the phone, and she gave me a blow-by-blow description of what was happening. And so, and that fire was actually started in a regional park that's part of the city of Oakland. So how are those conditions in a way analogous, do you think, with what happened in Fort McMurray?
They are. I mean, you know, what happened in 1991 was the beginning of a long-term trend that we've seen, is that things are getting warmer. We're getting more and more people living, playing, and working in forested environments. And what Oakland Hills demonstrated very clearly at the time was that no one was prepared to deal with that fire. Those people that were, you know, abandoning their cars on the highways, didn't know where to go, which direction to go, what to do, and it was kind of chaos. And we see that pattern of events continuing. California's, I think, probably done the best job of trying to educate people about wildfire and what to do in a wildfire situation. Places like Montana are also doing a pretty good job because they've had so many fires, but really not enough. I think there's just not this recognition that we're going to get hit. We are not in the line of fire. It's going to happen someplace else. And increasingly, that's just not the case in Fort McMurray and what's happening in California this year, what happened in British Columbia this year.
And in Oregon this year.
In Oregon. And, you know, I have to say that I was driving through the Rocky Mountains in October on my way back from the West Coast, and I drove for 6 hours through a blizzard. And a week after that blizzard, Waterton National Parks, which is on the Alberta-Montana border, had to be evacuated because of a wildfire, one of the hottest, most severe fires that they've ever had. And it's astonishing to think that in October, in the Rocky Mountains, we're having fires as extreme as that one.
And actually, the fire in Fort McMurray started in May, didn't it?
It started on the 1st of May, yeah.
And that's pretty early for fire season.
It's very early for fire season. And to give at least the Alberta government credit, they started ramping up their fire response teams on March the 1st, a month earlier than they normally would have, because I think a lot of the firefighters see this coming. It's just the policymakers really haven't been able to come to grips with this. I think what we're seeing now in places like California is that we're seeing year-round fire seasons now. And increasingly, that's happening in the northern states and in Canada as well, that you can have a fire at almost any time of year. I mean, Alaska's had several winter fires that, you know, kind of boggles the mind that they could have fires that far north.
Well, in California, it was kind of a standing joke of a negative sort that there were three seasons in California. There was fire, flood, and riot. The riots haven't been happening so much anymore, but certainly the floods and the fires are a very big thing. This used to be the vision, particularly that Northern Californians had of Southern California. But when the Santa Rosa fire broke out, the fires in Sonoma and Napa and Mendocino County, it was a real shock, I think, for a lot of people living in Northern California to realize that they had done to themselves the same thing that people in Southern California had been doing going back to the 1920s. So I want to get back to that whole thing of people living tucked into these canyons that are very dry and basically living in fire sheds. And that this was a trend that started in Southern California. Now it seems to have spread all around North America. We all probably understand why people want to live there, but what do we need to think about if we're making that choice, and how do we actually help people to not make that choice anymore?
Well, I think number one is that, you know, if you're going to live in a forested environment, I think that that municipalities and counties probably should be involved in this, is that, you know, forget about building a wood-sided house with wood-shakes shingles on the roof. People have to recognize that if they're going to landscape planting cedars and junipers, which are highly combustible, next to the house to make it look pretty, is not a good idea. And as we learned from Fort McMurray, most of the houses that burned had wooden fences, you know, within 3 feet of the side of the house. And those fences were either cedar or spruce, which are highly combustible. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of ignition sources right next to a house. And I think that in a more holistic way is that that communities, those small communities, Fort McMurray being one of them, it's a fairly large one, 90,000 people, there was no buffer between the forest and the outlying neighborhoods. In fact, you know, that very thick forest was right next door. So there was no place for firefighters to be able to anchor in to fight the fire and preventing it from coming into town. I have to qualify that is that these buffers are helpful, but not entirely, 100% useful, because embers can be shot out 2 miles in advance of a fire. So, you really can't have a 2 or 3 mile wide buffer zone. That's huge. That's deforestation.
Well, actually, I'm thinking the Eagle Creek fire that burned just 20 miles east of Portland this late summer and fall. At one point, an ember jumped the Columbia River, and I think it must have jumped at least gone 5 miles and started another fire on Archer Mountain on the Washington side, which didn't amount to that much compared to what was burned on the Oregon side. But the idea that the Columbia River is not a fire buffer, I think, is a rather sobering thought. And I wonder what that makes us realize about the veracity, in a way, of the fires that we're witnessing, and maybe some changes in attitude we have to make about how we manage them, I guess.
You're absolutely right. And that's exactly what happened in Fort McMurray, is that the firefighters assumed that the Athabasca River, which is, almost a mile and a half wide, 2 miles wide in some spots, would be the buffer that would prevent the fire from coming to town. And they were all shocked when the embers just shot over top of that river. This is, I think, the eye-opener that every community has to recognize, is that winds like the Santa Ana winds become much more powerful as the climate warms. It's just a fact of nature. When you've got mountains, hot air meeting cooler air from the Pacific, it just creates a lot of energy, and when these winds start driving a fire, there's really very little that firefighters can do. There's no amount of water bombers, firefighters on the ground, or heavy equipment that's going to be able to stop that fire. It's like spitting on a campfire, really. They may be able to steer it in a bit of a different direction. But in cases like this, we've got to make our communities much more resilient to fire and recognize that this is going to be a fact of nature in the future.
Well, we've had many discussions on this show about how fire is very beneficial for forests, and we'll probably talk about that some today, too, because that's the other wisdom that's kind of really come to the surface in the last 20 years or so, well, particularly since the Yellowstone fire, which was 1987, I think. That fire is a very important beneficial force in the forest landscape. And so the model has been argued, and not always followed by the Forest Service, that you let fires burn in wilderness areas, usually, and they'll burn themselves out and they do what they're supposed to be doing. It's really different, though, when the fire is burning at the edge of town. And I just think about whether it was the images last year of Fort McMurray, or the images of seeing the fire burning at the edges of Santa Rosa a couple months ago, and now burning in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties and San Diego, that we're watching. It's a different thing when people's lives are at stake, and it's not. I'm not sure you could say that fire is a beneficial force in urban communities. Or how do we turn fire into a beneficial force in urban communities?
It's very difficult, And I mean, this is the conundrum for most policymakers: is that fire is good for the landscape. It regenerates the forest, as Yellowstone demonstrated. So many people from President Ronald Reagan down into the Interior Secretary, people thought that, they'd lost an iconic place in their world. Yellowstone National Park was sacred. But within, months of that fire, it became pretty obvious that, grizzly bears were moving in to feed on carrion, and the following year that they were feeding on berries, that started to grow because they couldn't under the darkness of the large canopies. So that was good. The problem in most places in the United States and many parts of Canada is that we've just got too many people living in these forest environments for us to be able to allow fires to take their course. We can control burns, but that becomes problematic as well, is because if you want to do a controlled burn in, say, Yellowstone or Banff, you can't always do it at the optimum time of year because of all the tourists that are in there. So what are you going to do? Shut down Yellowstone or Banff National Park for, several weeks to allow firefighters to go in there and do controlled burns? It becomes politically impossible to do that. So we've got to resort to something else. And I think that's where the sort of discussion has got to come about.
Well, actually, I've had some rather draconian thoughts myself since the fire burned through the Columbia Gorge this summer. And one of my senses was, I mean, the last time I'd gone hiking in the gorge was last spring. It was so crowded. And it was just awful. And I said, I'm not going to go hiking here anymore, you know, after like March, because it's just too crowded. And it was really being abused. And there were lots and lots of people that went there without any idea of what it even meant to hike. I mean, they just kind of going because they saw a photograph on Instagram and said, oh, this is a cool place. And in fact, I was hiking last week up in Mount Hood, and there's a sign telling people that this is a serious thing when you go hiking, and you know, all the comforts of home that aren't there, kind of reminding people when you go in the woods, you need to be able to take care of yourself, and you have to know what wood etiquette is and also what wood survival is. So my thought was, after the fire burned, well, this needed to happen. It's also rejuvenating the forest, unlike the fires in Sonoma and in the counties around California or around Fort McMurray. This fire did burn where it was supposed to burn, and it's very, very good thing for the forest. But my thought is, maybe people have to stop going there for a while, or we have to do major education about people's responsibilities when they're in the woods so they don't start these fires, and that if we could get people out of there, the fires could burn in a way that was really beneficial.
You know, I have to agree with you. I kind of chuckled to myself when you talked about your own experiences. I was hiking with my daughter in the Rocky Mountains this summer, and, you know, we had two things to deal with smoke from the fires that came in from British Columbia that made it unpleasant to do the hike. And number two was that there was this long train of people going up this mountainside. You know, a couple of them, you know, had boom boxes on their backpacks, you know, playing them out loud, and you thought, well, what are they doing out here? Why bother coming out? Is this just a, you know, exercise skill, or, you know, do you really want to get away from this? And I think that we've sort of lost this connection with the wild. Not all of us, but many of us have, and I think, you know, we've got to find a way of re-educating people or educating people about, you know, why it's out there, and how do our forests evolve, and what our relationship is with our forests. And I think that that's kind of lost.
Well, actually, I'm going to one-up you here. I was hiking on the north side of Mount Hood last summer, actually, and the smoke from the British Columbia fires was making it a rather, probably very unhealthy hike. And we were, you know, in a very remote area, and it came upon a bunch of people that were they were at this beautiful viewpoint where the trail opens up for the first time, and you see this beautiful view of Mount Hood. And they had solar arrays laid out on these rocks. And I said, what are you doing? And they said, well, we're charging our cell phones. I said, what do you need your cell phones for? They said, well, we're going to be out here for 6 days, because they were hiking the whole mountain. I said, you can't live without your cell phones for 6 days, or I think it was 4 days. And I started getting into this kind of reprimanding thing about, don't you appreciate that the wood should be a screen-free place? And they were looking at me like I was just this crazy old lady, and they just, you know, continued charging their cell phones.
Well, I'm going to one-up you. Is our National Park Service in Canada has now made Wi-Fi accessible on some mountaintops, so that people can take selfies of themselves on these mountaintops and send them out, which is totally bizarre. You know, they neglect so much of what is going on in the national parks, and they're trying to make, you know, say social media part of it. And I just think that it's just ill-advised.
Yeah, well, I think we have to raise our voices louder.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric Strutzik, who's the author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. And we're talking about the kind of cataclysmic change in the fire regime over probably like the last 25, 30 years, and ways that we have to figure out how to live with fire at the same time that we have to maybe figure out some ways to prevent some of the fires that are happening. Back to Banff, which in your book you describe a lot of descriptions of Banff and this wonderful mountain. You can climb outside of Banff and see the whole valley and how fire prone it is. And I was thinking, I was in Banff for the first time in many, many years, just about 2 years ago, and I hated it. I mean, because I had been there in 1970 when it was pretty remote and really beautiful, way before Wi-Fi and selfies on the top of mountains. And the whole place had been so commercialized and so overrun, and it was just kind of a heartbreak. For people who go there more often, I guess you get acclimated like the frog in the boiling pot of water, so you don't have that reaction. So it's two sides. So part of it is like looking at kind of, I think, the tragedy of a place like Banff and this places like that all over the North America that have been kind of overdone. And then the other part of it is the fire danger. So I want you to describe the experience you had being up on that mountain with a fire expert who was sort of describing how Banff would have to evacuate if it was struck by fire.
Well, this trip got its start with an invitation by two of the architects of the National Park's firefighting strategies, who had recently been retired and have been long concerned that a big fire is going to impair the lives of many, many tourists and possibly residents in the town of Banff in the Rocky Mountains. And they took me to Sulphur Mountain, and there's a tramway, or there's one of these tramways that goes up the mountainside, and it takes, you know, usually, you know, most of the people are elderly German or Japanese tourists that don't speak a lot of English, generally are not wearing hiking boots or outdoor gear. You know, they've just got out of their cars, and they're either in sandals or high heels, and they're taken to the top of the mountain. There's actually a very nice interpretive center at the top of the mountain. You can get a nice lunch, you can have a drink, and you can have a look at the view. But it's forested from the bottom to the very top. And the recently retired Parks Canada scientists said, you know, that one day we're going to have a fire. In the valley down here, it's going to be either started by a camper, or there's a lot of illegal camping there, or possibly a lightning strike. And under conditions like we saw, say, in Fort McMurray, that fire will race up the mountainside. And I asked, well, how quick can it get from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain? And they said, if the winds favor the fire, it could get there in 10 or 15 minutes. And so potentially you could have 1,500 people on top of that mountain, several hundred people who decided to walk on the pathways. How do you get those people out of there in 10 or 15 minutes? It just can't happen. And then it just gets worse. It's because if you get up on top, once the fire reaches the top, it starts spitting out embers. And what's on the other side? The bottom of the mountain on the other side is the town of Banff. And so if you have a fire like you had in Fort McMurray beginning to burn up Banff, how do you get rid of, say, 35,000 residents and tourists that might be there? You said you were in Banff. You probably were aware of this. If it was in the summertime, traffic was probably pretty bad and you weren't moving very, very quickly. So how would you get firefighters in, people out? I know that the Canadian Park Service is working on a plan. They're well aware of this. And I think that they ideally would like to do a controlled burn on the side of that mountain. But they're caught between a rock and a hard place, because if you burn that mountain, then the company that owns the tramway and the interpretive center on the top is going to lose an awful lot of money, because who's going to want to come to Banff to have a look at a charred hillside? And this is the problem that a lot of agencies are facing now.
Well, actually, this is where I think we could do a cultural educational shift. I did a radio project a number of years ago about the Biscuit Fire in Southern Oregon, and got to walk through this beautiful post-fire landscape. It started out with some post-fire logging, which was hideous, and then you get through the Snag Forest, and it really was very beautiful. And it was at that point, I think it was 4 years since the fire. It really changed my mind, my whole sense about the relationship between fire and the woods, and understanding how a post-fire landscape has its own beauty. So then when my very favorite place on the north side of Mount Hood burnt up a few years ago, I was really excited to walk through the forest the next year and to witness that and see it at a much earlier stage. And I go up there every year, except this year I got burnt out because I couldn't. By the time I was going to go on that hike, the Eagle Creek fire had started. But I think that there's a beauty to post-fire landscapes that people could maybe learn about and understand. You see all this incredible understory vegetation that comes in, and seeing blackback woodpeckers and all the wildlife that comes back. So do you think there's a way we could get people to appreciate the beauty of burnt forests?
Yeah, I think, you know, and that's probably the responsibility of, you know, people like you and the media is try to educate people about this, that it isn't the end of the world. You know, Yellowstone came back very nicely after those fires. I hearken back to, you know, a place where I lived. I lived in Yukon, and I know Alaska very well, and they have huge fires up there. But, you know, a year after those fires, this plant called fireweed grows back. And so you have these mountains that were charred that summer, but then the following year turned this beautiful magenta. And they stay that way for most of the summer, and they can go on for 3 or 4 years. It's absolutely gorgeous, you know. I think that if people were aware of the beauty that arises from, you know, the ashes of a fire, they would come to more appreciate that this is really the way that nature works. I think it's a cultural problem for us, and is that we see fire as evil. And, you know, the National Park Service in both Canada and the United States, one of the reasons why they kicked out Native Americans out of Yosemite, Yellowstone, Banff, and Jasper National Parks was that they were fire starters. These people who lived in those forests, when those forests became too mature, they did their own controlled burns so that it would bring back the elk and the deer and the bears that moved off to more open areas. And it would also bring back the berries, you know, that stopped growing as prolifically as they did when the forest was mature. And the National Park Service on both sides of the border just recognized this as just an insane thing to do. And so they kicked these people out of the park. There were other reasons as well, but that was one of the reasons, is that they were fire starters. And we've inherited that belief in our culture, that fire is bad. Somehow we've just got to educate people that this is necessary. This is the way nature works. Before we got here, lightning started fires. There were no firefighters out there to put them out. And when we arrived on the scene, things looked pretty nice. I mean, we had 50 million bison roaming the prairies. We had very healthy populations of wildlife in our forests. So fire is part of that ecosystem.
Well, while we're talking about how beneficial fire is to the landscape, the usual conversation on the show, the other part of it is, because you're the second person I've interviewed about this, about megafires, that there's a lot of potential destruction that's threatened by these fires. And a lot of it has to do with some of the places where they're burning and the intensity with which they're burning. Now, on the one hand, megafires like the Yellowstone fire and the Biscayne fire ultimately are healthy for the landscape, but there seems to be a change in the capacity for a lot of parts of North America, particularly here in the Northwest, to be able to withstand some of the fire regimes that are happening. So let's talk a little bit about how the fires have changed over the last 30 years or so, and some ways in which the fire maybe is not good for the landscape anymore.
Well, this is still open debate, but I've pretty much settled on the belief that we are now beginning to see fires that are burning so intensely that almost nothing grows back, because it burns into the duff. It burns the seeds that would normally survive a fire and bring back the forest. And we have examples of that in the subarctic of Alaska and northern Canada and northern Quebec. We have a pretty good example of that right now in Waterton National Park, where a fire burned so hot this October that it reduced much of that forest to char. Usually, you know, after a fire, there's a lot of snags still standing, and they'll stand for 10 years, and they're great for woodpeckers. That is important to recognize, that maybe we are entering a new paradigm here where fires are burning hotter than they have before. And how we deal with this is becoming increasingly a problem, because Waterton, like Colorado did in 2002 when the Hayman fire burned, you know, really incinerated the forest around the riverbeds, it just creates a huge erosion problem all along these riverbanks, and then the ash and all of the chemicals that are stored in the soil just get washed downstream, and then threatens water treatment plants. It threatens sports fisheries, all kinds of freshwater life.
Well, another threat that's kind of, I think, new, especially with these urban wildfires, is that there's lots and lots of toxins that are getting burnt up. I think that was the case in parts of California, Northern California, that burned. It's probably also the case in Southern California when that burns. So what are some of those dangers when places closer to where people live are burning up?
This is an emerging question that public health officials now are starting to grapple with, is that in communities, I mean, let's just look at it in a more pure environment, is that wood smoke from just a normal wildfire contains many of the same chemicals that you find in tobacco smoke. And so if you're exposed to them for any length of time, especially if you've got respiratory problems, you're vulnerable. The problem with cities is that, you know, we build houses with a lot of oils, plastics, all kinds of chemicals that burn, and most firefighters recognize this. You know, they have their air filters that they put on to protect themselves. But what about those people who live, you know, maybe a mile away that are maybe subjected to the particulates from that fire? And now we also know that those particulates can travel a long way. And they can cause health problems from, you know, we know that the 2004 Alaska fires, the particulates got all the way down to Houston that year and raised ozone levels to dangerous levels. We also know that the fires in northern Quebec were responsible for a 50% spike in hospitalizations in several New England states. So this is something that, you know, public health officials are now coming to grips with, but we really don't know enough about this to be able to evaluate, other than to say that, you know, this is not good.
Well, another thing that your book points out that I think a lot of listeners probably are not aware of is how much the fire regime has changed in the northern latitudes. I mean, you've made some references to fires in northern Canada and Alaska. And a few years ago, there were a lot of fires in Russia, as I recall, you know, up close to the Arctic Circle. And I think there were some, like, in Siberia as well as in the actual Russian Republic. Why is there an increase in the number of wildfires in these boreal areas? And what is it indicative of?
I think there's an increase in these mega fires in Alaska and northern Canada and obviously Russia, is that the boreal forest, which is really a forest that was born to burn because it's dependent on fire to regenerate those forests, they're burning a lot more often and in bigger areas because the Arctic is warming faster than any other place on Earth. And so we are creating a tinder dry conditions in a circumpolar environment. And what's compounding the problem is that when these forests burn, they also hasten the thawing of the permafrost. And so these forests have a hard time recovering. And also, you got to throw drought in there. So you have these coniferous forests now being replaced by aspen, poplar forest, and it's a widespread occurrence right across the north.
Well, another thing you talk about is how these fires are changing the hydrology. I like this two chapters. One is basically water on fire and fire on ice. So let's talk about those two kind of water-fire phenomenon that are a result of these megafires.
Well, I think the Hayman Fire of 2002 in Colorado was, you know, just a classic example of how the hydrology can be affected by a fire, is that, you know, all the trees burned along the riverbanks, and so there was nothing really to absorb the moisture that came with the heavy rains that followed. So everything that burned got washed into the river system and essentially clogged the river system all the way down to Denver and threatened to throw out their water treatment plants. In fact, I think they hired something like 75 scientists and planted 175,000 trees to try to stabilize those riverbanks, you know, to kind of restore the hydrology that was there before. And it succeeded to some extent, but, you know, the South Platte sport fishery was one of the best inland trout fisheries in the United States, still hasn't fully recovered because the chemical composition of that river has not been restored. And we're finding municipalities right across North America now that are faced with this problem of, you know, places like Portland that don't filter their water. You've got such good water, you don't need to filter it.
Those days may be over soon, but actually.
But places like Victoria as well, as I know, I've talked to people, you know, who are involved there, and they're extremely worried. You know, for example, the city of Victoria on Vancouver Island, they're very vulnerable to these fires upstream, and if those particulates start getting into the rivers that feed their water supply, they really have a hard time dealing with this. And Fort McMurray is another example. They have state-of-the-art filtration systems, but it all got clogged up. And when carbon meets chlorine, you produce carcinogenic chemicals. And so you really have to up the treatment. And Fort McMurray now is spending twice as much on treatment as they did the year before the fire, and next year they're probably going to have to double it again. It's not a problem that's going to go away because so much forest burned. And so you do have the this hydrology that is changing, and it's compounded by another problem that's taking place in a lot of the river systems, you know, in the American Northwest and in Canada, is that these rivers and lakes are now starting to warm up because of climate change. And what these forests, you know, adding these particulates, you just get this fundamental change in the chemical composition of our rivers and lakes that I think are a real concern.
Well, we're talking this morning with Edward Sturczyk, who is the author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. And we're talking about both the necessary role that fire plays in the woods, but also the incredible threat that we're being faced by these mega fires that are... I guess we're pretty much saying now that this is a result of climate change. We haven't made that exact connection. So I want to do two more things in the last few minutes we have of the show. First of all, I was thinking how every fire that we have been hearing about in the last, well, many years, but particularly this summer, what we've been hearing is there's high temperature, there's high winds, and it's extremely dry. So what do those three conditions, which have been fueling the fires in Southern California, as well as the fires in British Columbia, Montana, and here in the Columbia River Gorge, what do those three things have in common, and what is the most likely contributor to those three factors?
Well, you know, climate change is one of the big drivers of forest fire, because for every increase, you know, 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to need 15% more moisture to compensate for the imbalance that's created by that heating. And in places like California, you're not going to get 15% more moisture. In fact, probably going to get 15% less. Climate change is also, you know, the heat is also driving these winds that drive fire to move faster. And the faster the wind blows, the harder it is to contain a fire. We also expect in a climate change scenario a 50% increase in lightning strikes across the continental part of the United States and probably into Canada and Alaska as well. And lightning causes a third of all the fires on average in those places. And so it all adds up to fires burning bigger, hotter, faster, and more often down the road.
Your last chapter is talking about resilience and basically a call for hope. So after, now that we've depressed everybody about how we have this almost runaway fire regime that's happening, what can we do to make ourselves more resilient in the coming pyrocene, as your book refers to this age of fire that we're facing? And is there a way that we can actually turn this into something that's beneficial both to the planet and to our human communities?
Well, I think there is. You know, right off the bat, I think we've got to address the climate change issue in a more serious way. That's not going to eliminate the problem, but it will help solve the problem for people who are living in these environments 50 or 100, 150 years down the road. That's number one. But I think the other thing that we've got to do is that we've got to start recognize that fire, although it is extremely beneficial and necessary, we have to have a new relationship with it, the same kind of relationship we have with hurricanes and tornadoes, is that we've got to have recognize that we can't stop it, that there just aren't enough, you know, firefighters, water bombers, and heavy equipment to go around to be able to put out every single fire. It's not good because, you know, we need those fires, but at the same time, there just aren't the resources. And those resources that we're using right now are getting tapped out. Triaging has become almost the order of the day in California, in British Columbia, in Oregon, I think in 2015 as well, is that you can't fight all of these fires. So we've got to find a new way of adapting to this. Maybe perhaps more controlled burns in areas where we can do that. Better building codes that we need to have in place so that homes and communities are more resilient to fires, buffer zones between forest and communities. There are any number of things that we can do that we're just not doing. We are doing them in some places, but just not fast enough. In other places, we're ignoring them. So there's an awful lot that can be done.
Well, you mentioned in your book, I guess when you're standing on the top of Sulphur Mountain, comparing the way it looks now with the way it looked at the turn of the 20th century. So what was the difference, and what does that show us about maybe a direction we need to move towards?
Yeah, well, you know, it's again, if you look at, I was shown pictures of what Banff looked like about 80, 90 years ago, that same area. And there were very few trees. And the reason why there were no trees was that we weren't putting fires out at that time. And at the same time, North American native people were lighting fires to try to enhance, regenerate those forests for their benefit. What we have right now is just a backlog of old forests that we've protected, I think, you know, for very good intentions, because, you know, old growth forests are necessary for, and I don't propose to eliminate them, but in many places we haven't allowed young forests to take, you know, their rotation. And so we've created a forest, a huge swath of forest right across North America that is old and become more vulnerable, as you well know, in your part of the world, to bark beetles. And bark beetles kill trees really, really quickly. And then those trees, you know, at a certain stage, at the red stage, become very vulnerable to fires. And when they get knocked over, eventually by wind, they may not cause more fires, but it makes it more difficult to fight fires because of all of the tree trunks that are on the ground. We've got to kind of figure out, I don't propose that I know exactly what the roadmap is that we should be following down the future, but I think we've got to invest more in science. And I think that you've probably talked about this is on your program, is that we've really kind of impoverished our scientists. We haven't invested enough in wildfire science to really be able to understand is where is this all heading to and what can we do to adapt. Things that are happening in the forest that we've never seen before, like the Fort McMurray fire, created its own lightning storm, and that lightning triggered fires 30 or 20 miles in advance of the fire. No one had ever seen a cluster of fires ignite in front of that far in advance of a fire. It was the first time they'd ever seen anything like this. So we're starting to see behavior in fires that really is alarming.
Well, your government has finally shifted from being an anti-science government under Stephen Harper to, I'm hoping, a little bit more science-oriented under Justin Trudeau. The United States, on the other hand, is moving against science, in fact, taking the word science out of, you know, one of the words that can't be used by the CDC. So in the light of the problems politically with acknowledging the importance of funding scientific research, what do you see kind of actions that citizens can do to make sure that our scientists are funded and that we can work on these problems?
Well, it's an interesting perception you have. I think you're quite right about what's happening on your side of the border, but really all this government has done is stop the bleeding. Very little new money has been invested in fire science, for example. There were, I think, you know, 22,000 people working in the Canadian Forest Service in the 1990s. I think there are now 700 of them. And there's talk that they may eliminate or amalgamate the Forest Service altogether. Investment in this kind of new and emerging science just isn't coming. And, you know, I don't fault the government for it. I think that, you know, the problem is the government responds to what people want. And I think that until people really start talking about this, you know, with the people that represent them at various levels of government, not much is going to be done, because not much was done after Fort McMurray, and not much is being done after the British Columbia fires this year. We continue to respond the way we have, as we always have, and hope for the best in the future, and that's just not going to be good enough.
Well, I'm actually hoping here in Portland that the Columbia River Gorge fire really did spark a lot of interest in looking at the causes of the problems and looking at ways to change the future. So maybe we can be a model for the rest of the world.
I think so. You know, there are these little hot spots that, you know, pardon the expression, but hot spots of interest that are emerging because people realize that business as usual is not going to be successful anymore. We've got to start doing things differently. And that's a really good start. And I think that, you know, we see examples of this. We largely solved the acid rain problem that we had, you know, in the 1970s and the 1980s. And I think that, and, you know, we made great strides in dealing with the hole in the ozone layer. I think that this is one of these things that we can do something about, and we can walk away with a feeling that, okay, we're a little bit safer and we're better off than we were 10 years ago. So I don't think it's an impossible task. I think it's just starting to think differently.
Well, Edward, it's really good talking with you, and I enjoyed your book, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking with Edward Struzik, who's the author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week for Christmas, we'll be rerunning the interview with Marcus Erickson, author of Junkraft. You can learn what to do with all that plastic packaging that your Christmas presents are going to come in, and how not to pollute the ocean. The following week on New Year's Day, KBOO is going to be celebrating the life of longtime KBOO volunteer, board member, and former station manager Michael Wells. And I'll be back on January 8th, and we'll be talking with Eric DePlace, who's opening the second Trump future time capsule. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to get with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening.
It takes a whole pail of water just to cool him down.